today on Against the Grain. Can a writing project help Amazon workers reclaim their dignity? And what's the value, the political value, of cooperative board games? I'm CS. The teacher, writer, and game designer Max Haven joins me, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. The cultural theorist Max Haven is always up to things, always stirring the political pot in thoughtful and creative ways. One of his ongoing projects involves examining the relationship between board games and politics. An outgrowth of that has been games Max himself has designed, including one called Billionaires and Guillotines. Another initiative involved recruiting Amazon workers to participate in a science fiction writing project. That effort culminated in the publication of a book titled The World After Amazon: Speculative Stories from Amazon Workers. Max Haven is Canada Research Chair in the Radical Imagination at Lakehead University in Ontario, Canada, where he directs the Reimagining Value Action Lab. When Max and I connected recently, I began by asking him about Amazon's power and influence.
Most listeners are presumably familiar with Amazon as a source of many of the consumer products they buy or that people they know buy. It's the world's largest online retailer. It's one of the largest retailers in the world. It's also one of the world's top private employers with, you know, somewhere in the range of 2 to 4 million employees, depending on how you crunch the numbers. It has, in and of itself, an economy that rivals and exceeds that of many countries on Earth. It is a vast corporate empire. And over the last 30 years since it was founded in the 1990s, it began by being a bookseller and expanded into selling electronics. It now has a movie studio. It has a grocery store since it bought Whole Foods and many other subsidiaries beside. And one thing that I think is unique about Amazon is that it's built this empire through using its incredible control over data and computing power to find industries that it can disrupt and destroy and basically undercut them to the point where other business models are impossible, and then basically gain what is effectively a monopoly, which is why, in fact, it's been investigated in the United States and other jurisdictions as a monopoly in many cases. But in the project that I worked on, which we'll talk about in a minute, I imagine, which is called The Worker Speculative Society or The World After Amazon, we were beginning to think about the corporation as a storyteller. And one of the ways that Amazon has been able to expand and build its empire is through the stories it tells. Now, primarily, that's the stories it tells through its founder, Jeff Bezos, who is a huge science fiction fan and has rolled all of these science fiction ideas and tropes and narratives into the way he talks about the company, which has been extremely successful at gaining investment, convincing consumers to shop from the company, convincing regulators not to regulate the company or to allow it to, for instance, get away with not paying its taxes, all in the name that Amazon is some sort of angel from the future, a kind of science fiction fantasy brought to life. But beyond just that, beyond its own narrative, we also have to reckon with the fact that Amazon now controls a massive proportion of the literary market. It is the main means by which Americans and many people around the world access books. That's especially the case for ebooks and audiobooks, where they have just a completely dominant market share. And beyond even that, what many people maybe don't know is the most profitable section of Amazon is its Amazon Web Services division, which basically provides the infrastructure for about half of the public-facing internet by some estimates. So it's not an exaggeration to say that if words are passing by the eyes of a human being in 2025 when we're recording this interview, there's a very good chance that those words passed in some way through Amazon. And that gives the firm an incredible amount of power, not only in terms of its commercial and economic power, but also in terms of the ideas we have, the stories we tell, and the way that we express the world to ourselves as now a global species.
And how does Amazon treat its workers?
I mean, notoriously badly. Every step of the way in the corporate hierarchy, Amazon is built on the abuse and exploitation of workers. Now, that's most famously been seen in the films and television documentaries that have shown people into their massively technologically augmented warehouses, where human beings work alongside robots to fulfill the orders of Amazon's customers. In those warehouses, the rates of injury of workers are quite a bit higher than the rest of the logistics industry. We've also seen stories over the last decade of the kind of pace that's expected of Amazon's delivery drivers, whether they're working for the company themselves, going out on deliveries, or they're working for subsidiary companies that are wholly dependent on Amazon to deliver Amazon parcels. Those workers are expected to use, in both the warehouses and the delivery drivers, apps and digital devices that measure their movements and try and essentially force them to move and work as efficiently as possible in the name of customer satisfaction, allegedly, but truly in the name of just corporate profits, so that Amazon can hire as few workers as possible to fulfill these orders. But even throughout the rest of the corporate supply chain, there's a huge amount of exploitation. There's been many complaints by corporate workers at Amazon that it's a very merciless and demanding and fast-paced environment. It seems that on every level, Amazon is quite content to burn through workers very quickly. There were reports that, you know, the average worker at Amazon only lasts in a warehouse for about a year and a half before they suffer from some sort of injury that makes them incapable of working or simply burn out. And then Amazon as well has been in the forefront of new forms of exploitation through, for instance, its Amazon MTurk or Mechanical Turk platform. And this is basically an online clearinghouse for micro labor. So a worker anywhere in the world can sign up and then bid against other workers to do very minute tasks for very cheaply. For instance, help train an AI by feeding it information about whether an image that is generated is one of a cat or a dog or a raccoon. And similarly, employers anywhere in the world can now access the MTurk platform in order to find such exploitable workers. So ultimately, Amazon is almost a science fiction dystopian character in and of itself, insofar as it is, you know, really at the vanguard of figuring out ways to exploit and extort labor in the 21st century.
Max, you started and led the Worker as Futurist Project, which recently published the book, The World After Amazon, Speculative Stories from Amazon Workers. Tell us about the origins of the Worker as Futurist Project and what it aims to do.
Several years ago, I think in 2019, I was part of an art group that got a commission to do a piece of participatory art with so-called ghost workers. These are workers who are essential to the functioning of the digital economy, but whose labor and exploitation is rendered invisible. So like ghosts, they sort of haunt our digital networks. And we were tasked with collaborating with workers on the MTurk platform, which I mentioned before. And through that, I became very interested in Amazon and assembled a small group of scholars and artists and activists to try and study the firm from a kind of alternative perspective. And then the pandemic hit, and we ended up doing a lot of this research on our own and collaborating online. And one of the questions I asked that small group of thinkers was, if you could do a project against Amazon of your choosing, if you got a grant to do a kind of project that you wished you could do, what would it be? And in trying to answer that question, I realized that I had become quite interested in Jeff Bezos's fascination with science fiction, and also his profound misreading of science fiction. This is a man who is reputed to have one of the largest collections of science fiction novels that exists, as well as science fiction paraphernalia. Famously, he plowed the massive profits he made from Amazon into his own, basically, private space program, Blue Origin. He confesses himself proudly to be a huge space nerd and science fiction nerd. And I began to think that Amazon, if we look at it from the perspective of its workers, as I mentioned a moment ago, appears to be a kind of dystopian scene, like something that would have been imagined as a nightmare 50 or 100 years ago by the pioneers of science fiction. And yet here it is being brought to life by a person who claims to be a huge fan of science fiction. And I began to ask, well, what do the workers think about the future? I mean, ultimately, a worker at Amazon is being compelled through the mute compulsion of the capitalist economy to essentially build Jeff Bezos's utopia while they themselves dwell in the dystopia that his, you know, corporate greed is creating. And it's not just exploitation, it's also that workers, both at Amazon and in the capitalist economy generally, have been denied any voice or any real agency within the future that we're creating, whether it's the development of artificial intelligence or life extension or space travel. These are regimes that are increasingly being invented, funded, and directed by billionaires, where workers are essentially going to be left behind on Earth to die or to feed a corporate machine for their boss's fantasies. So I asked, well, what would it be like for workers to have an opportunity to articulate their own visions of the future, whether they're utopian or dystopian or neither or both? And through that came the idea of the Workers' Futurist Project, where we would set up writing workshops for Amazon workers to give them the tools and give them the support to tell their own stories and see them published and start to have conversations about them.
Max Haven joins me on Against the Grain. That's H-A-I-V-E-N. He is a writer and teacher and Canada Research Chair in the Radical Imagination at Lakehead University in Canada. He is a cultural theorist of social movements and financialization. We are talking about a number of things with him today. One of them is the book, The World After Amazon, Speculative Stories from Amazon Workers, which features 9 short stories written by current and former Amazon workers. It's available in print form, online, and as a printable PDF. It's also available as a free audiobook on againstthegrain.org. We've put links to the publication that Max Haven has been involved in as part of the Worker as Futurist Project. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. In devising and executing this project, you folks were inspired by the Worker Writers School and Workers' Inquiry. Workers' Inquiry first emerged in Italy in the 1970s. Worker Writers School is based in New York. I think it started maybe in 2011. Tell us about those two projects and what you drew from them.
Well, there is a long history of workers' writing as a form of resistance that goes back centuries. And in fact, some of the first schools, as we understand them today, were not provided by the state, but were in fact provided by workers to themselves to help cultivate the skills of literacy as a way of opening a space for the imagination and a means to communicate, to build solidarity and fight back against systems of domination and exploitation. So it's important to place these initiatives in a longer trajectory of writing as a tool of the radical imagination for workers. The Workers' Writers' School, as you mentioned, was initiated by Mark Nowak, the poet, as an attempt to return to workers the power of poetry, which, you know, I think in the English language has often been associated with the ruling class, but has in fact always been a major part of working class communities and continues to be a major part of working class communities through, for instance, the musical genre of hip hop, where poetics are used as a means to speak about common struggles and class struggles. But Nowak created an initiative and works with other organizations to fund it and support it, where workers are invited to come and learn how to write haiku poetry and other poetic forms, and then use that to write about their struggles, not only, you know, their collective struggles for dignity and wages and better working conditions, but also the everyday struggles of just being a working person in a hostile capitalist economy, or the daily struggle of finding beauty in a world that tries to steal it or deny it. And it's a very beautiful experiment. There have been many, many workers who've passed through the school in New York and also in some of its satellite activities beyond New York City. And it was very inspiring for us to think about this experiment and more generally what Nowak calls social poetics. So poetry as a form of social intervention and creative writing as a form of solidarity building. And this for us dovetailed with the example of workers' inquiry, which, as you mentioned, is a methodology of Marxist thinking that was developed in the 1970s, for the most part in Italy, in a place where, you know, at that time, the self-designated representatives of the working class in the form of trade unions and the Communist Party had become increasingly conservative. And we're not able to really contain the demands or the forms of identity of a new generation of workers who were finding themselves displaced from their rural homes or forced to move for work, and now in these massive, increasingly technologically sophisticated factories. And so what this sort of a new generation of Marxist agitators and thinkers started to do is to have reading groups and writing groups with workers to try and investigate capitalism from the perspective of the shop floor and to set aside the sort of the theoretical and ideological baggage of an earlier form of Marxist concern for workers' rights and instead say, actually, what does the workers' own experience tell them and tell us about how capitalism is changing and how class struggle is changing and how class is changing in our moment? And since then, many people have used the workers' inquiry method in order to try and do precisely this, to theorize from the proverbial shop floor. So there's incredible work being done recently by sex workers and by delivery drivers and by video game workers, where workers use writing, for instance, answer questionnaires or write testimonials about what their workday is like, or, you know, read famous theoretical texts and respond to them, as a way of doing this kind of grassroots theorization and bottom-up theorization. And the workers' inquiry method doesn't always include writing, but it often includes writing and the sharing of writing through publication. Like, for instance, our friends at the publication Notes from Below, which is a journal dedicated to both publishing workers' writing about the changing economy and also developing methods and theories for how workers' writing can be an important part of workers' struggle today.
So in order to produce The World After Amazon, speculative stories from Amazon workers, you folks had to recruit current and former Amazon workers, and then you had to support them, and I think it was a subset of them, to write short stories, short science fiction stories, in response to, actually, to the prompt, The World After Amazon. Tell us about the process of bringing people on board and then supporting their writing process.
Yeah, so starting in about 2021, we began the project in earnest, and we were fortunate enough to receive a grant from the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada to do the project. And we began with a science fiction film club. So me and my colleagues, Xenia Benevolsky and Graham Webb, used the internet to invite current and former Amazon workers who were not managers to apply to join this club. And we would meet every week online to watch various science fiction films and television, including Star Trek or Snowpiercer, or episodes of Black Mirror, and talk about their resonance with Amazon workers. We also ended up playing some games by the game company Mola Industria, which produces very interesting satirical games about capitalism, and, you know, engaging with a number of other cultural texts as well. And through that, we got to know a lot of workers. We had managed to recruit them by, for instance, posting advertisements on Reddit forums and Facebook groups, as well as working with our collaborators in trade unions and social movements that are engaged with Amazon workers. And we gave the workers who participated in the film club a small stipend for participating with us and sharing their views. And then that gave us some experience of engaging with Amazon workers and built some trust. And so then the subsequent year, we began to recruit for a smaller group that ended up being 13 people of Amazon workers who wanted to be part of a writing workshop rather than just watching and discussing science fiction films, to actually learn how to write science fiction short stories with the idea that they would be published in the end. And we were able to bring in a wide variety of Amazon workers. Some worked in warehouses, some were drivers, some did copywriting, some worked for companies that were wholly dependent on Amazon, but they didn't work for Amazon themselves. Some of them were resellers. So these are basically independent merchants who list products on Amazon and use Amazon's platform to try and reach their consumers, where Amazon, of course, as you might imagine, takes a huge chunk of their revenue. Also, we had MTurk workers and others who worked in various ways for Amazon. And these people came together for a series of weeks and were given a stipend to work with us and study how to write speculative fiction, short stories. Here we brought in my colleague at Lakehead University, Sarah Olatula, who is a creative writing teacher and a well-published speculative fiction author. And her and Graham and Xenia were able to pass on a number of skills around world building, character development, plot development. And then over the subsequent months, the participants in our project wrote short stories. They would come together in a community of practice every few weeks online to share their stories and get feedback on the writing so that they could revise it. And then later on down the line, we as a team helped edit their stories to bring out the kind of literary qualities without really jeopardizing their unique voice. And then we worked with a professional editor, Candida Hadley, to edit the stories in the final instance so that they were ready for publication. All, of course, with the writer's consent and green lighting. And yes, as you mentioned, the ultimate product was released in the fall of 2024, and we published it as a print-on-demand book, which people can order as a physical copy, also as a free ebook and PDF, and it's also HTML on our website for accessibility. And we also had the well-known Canadian actor and broadcaster Sukian Lee as the voice actor to record the stories as an audiobook and free podcast as well. Because one of the things we heard from many Amazon workers is that the nature of their job does give them some opportunities to have their ears free for listening to podcasts and audiobooks. So that was the best way to reach them if we wanted other Amazon workers to engage with the stories.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. Max Haven joins us. He directs the Reimagining Value Action Lab, a workshop for the radical imagination, social justice, and decolonization at Lakehead University in Ontario, Canada, where he teaches. He has written a number of books, including Palm Oil, The Grease of Empire, and Revenge Capitalism. And he's currently a senior visiting research fellow at University College London's Institute for Advanced Studies. We are talking right now about a book that he participated in the creation of. It's called The World After Amazon, Speculative Stories from Amazon Workers. You used the word dignity earlier, Max, and you and your collaborators and co-editors write that we should not underestimate how much dignity workers reclaim when they recognize themselves as creatives and creative writers. Elaborate on that.
Well, let's think about an Amazon worker in a warehouse. Essentially, it's very clear to every worker there that they are essentially meat in a machine. And that machine is mostly made of robots, and that the robots are more valuable than the workers. The workers are only there until, at least theoretically, Amazon can automate them out of a job. But the reality, as your listeners will know from many of the other interviews you've done with experts on automation, is that it's almost always cheaper to hire a human to do a mundane task that a robot could do than it is to build and maintain a robot, because our ability to exploit human labor is sadly, under the capitalist system, much greater. And, you know, it's just generally much more profitable. So that, I think, is transparent to workers at Amazon. They know they're being exploited. But there's another level of exploitation as well. It's not just that you are being instrumentalized to be part of this profit-making machine. It's also that you are, you can see all around you that the future is being built. These robots are state of the art. The warehouse and the logistics system of which it's a part are, you know, world-leading. But that's not a world that is being created that includes you. You, as a worker at an Amazon warehouse, are going to be excluded from the very future that you're building. You are intended to live in the slums and work to death for the benefit of Jeff Bezos so that he and whoever else, his rich friends, can go to space. So there's something fundamentally that denies the dignity of workers as human beings in the Amazon apparatus as it stands. But there's also something that denies the dignity of the fact that we humans are creatures that are able to imagine and imagine together and envision and create futures together. But what Amazon is essentially doing, like many capitalist firms, is stealing that power from workers and concentrating all the power to create the future in the hands of a very few individuals at the top of the corporate hierarchy. So part of what we wanted to do in Worker is Futurist and what a number of initiatives are doing is saying, in fact, it's not enough to fight for wages and working conditions. That's, of course, important. And there are many important efforts to try and unionize Amazon or organize Amazon workers for that purpose. But in addition to that, and as part of that struggle, we also need to create spaces and times when workers can give themselves back their dignity as full, rich human beings with a right to practice their imagination and have that imagination valued. So, you know, I don't expect that the Workers Futurist Project is going to lead in and of itself to any great changes at Amazon or in the world, but it is part, I think, of a series of efforts by people who care about working people and working people themselves to reclaim a dignity of what it means to be future makers and what it means to recognize that to be human in this world is to have the power of the imagination and to be able to share that imagination with others and to recognize that each of our imaginations is unique and in dialogue with other unique imaginations as well.
Can you give us a sense of some of the, or maybe one or two of the plot lines of specific short stories in this book, The World After Amazon? And I also wonder if the stories strike you as pessimistic or dystopian, or as containing glimmers of hope, or maybe it's impossible to generalize.
There are some stories that are somewhat optimistic. So for instance, one writer, Ibrahim, wrote about a kind of a robot and a human who are married to each other, remembering to the moment when they were part of starting a revolution against Amazon and capitalism together, where robots and humans converged and built solidarity. And that's quite an optimistic story, although a wistful and sad one, because ultimately at the end, the robot chooses to die, essentially, rather than lose his memories of that event that they shared together. In another story, we have a kind of far future. Centuries after some sort of revolution has occurred that has wiped out Amazon but repurposed its technologies for the benefit of humanity. But the author of that story, who opted to remain anonymous, projected that even in that future there would be many problems for such a liberated society, and that society would not be beyond propaganda. But the rest of the stories, I think it's safe to say, are quite dystopian. They represent worlds where workers are even more oppressed and exploited than they are today, and sort of project outward from the present on trends that are occurring now to describe futures that might come to pass. However, I think the dystopian imagination shouldn't be seen as discouraging for perhaps two reasons. The first is, I think, the workers, as I've sort of mentioned, I think the workers are already living in a dystopia. To work for Amazon is to work in a dystopia that is mislabeled as a utopia. You know, Jeff Bezos' rhetoric about what the firm is doing and what it's providing customers and what it's providing society are painted in rosy hues But in fact, the reality is the stuff of science fiction nightmares. So if you live every day in a science fiction nightmare, it shouldn't surprise us that your imagination is dystopian. It is a reflection of your lived, embodied experience. But by the same token, what we see in a lot of the stories that have a more dystopian hue in The World After Amazon is that the moments of hope exist in the small slivers of solidarity and friendship and camaraderie and conviviality between the characters. So, you know, there's a story about Amazon ultimately creating a prison system to harvest prison labor. But within that story, there are glimmers of light as characters provide each other solidarity and care. There's a story about a family that's on the run from a sort of apocalyptic event which has occurred that has separated them, and they're trying to find each other again. There's a story about scientists who are wrapped up in attempts to eliminate death, but their companionship and solidarity with one another is what shows through as a kind of hopeful moment. And I think that really represents something that shouldn't be discounted. Maybe these stories are not bold visions of a transformed society, but I think they articulate an anti-capitalist set of values where human relationships and solidarity and care are at the forefront and are the means by which people survive.
Max Haven, part of the Worker as Futurist project, which recently published The World After Amazon, Speculative Stories from Amazon Workers. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. I want to move to the topic of games and board games and politics. Max has created a board game, Billionaires and Guillotines. It will be released by Pluto Press in this spring. And I want to set the stage for a discussion of that game by referring to or bringing out what Max wrote in Jacobin magazine recently about games and politics. And in that article, you talk about the board game industry. To what extent has that industry been biased toward games that are considered apolitical?
In recent years, the bias towards apolitical games has been very prevalent and quite disappointing, especially because it's a great departure from the origin of board games. Now, I mean, humans have been playing the thing we might today call board games since before there was writing. We found archaeological evidence, so it's certainly not new. But in the industrial age, board games arose with the printing press and, in fact, make use of essentially the same materials. And like the printing press, almost as soon as it was invented, it became a resource for workers and people struggling to change society to broadcast subversive and alternative and radical messages. So some of the earliest board games, in fact, in the 19th and 20th centuries, were, in fact, forms of social agitation. There was, for instance, a famous board game made by the suffragettes in London. Even the board game Monopoly was originally a kind of satire and social critique of capitalism well before it was bought out and turned into the commercial horror that we all know it as today. More recently, there has been what many people speak about as a board game renaissance, thanks to a number of converging factors. One of them is the ease with which people can do graphic design, also the affordances of crowdfunding, where game designers can propose their game to consumers and it can be funded before manufacturing, and also the vast expansion of manufacturing capacity for board games. You've also seen in cities and towns across the United States and around the world the proliferation of board game cafes, especially since the pandemic, because people want to be able to come together and have a convivial shared experience and meet new people, I think, in a framework that is comfortable and familiar and fun. But unfortunately, one of the drawbacks of that game renaissance is that there has been a bias, I think, towards apolitical or anti-political games, because most people associate games with just having fun and not learning or challenging our perceptions. And often people play board games to come together with other people that they might not otherwise spend time with, And there's a fear that a political board game might spark debates and uncomfortable discussions and divisions that people want to avoid. But on the other hand, I think the very same affordances that have led to the board game renaissance have allowed a number of radical board game designers to really advance products that I think are really phenomenal. Just to name a few, there's the Tisa Collective from Chicago that's been producing social movement adjacent games for a number of years. There's the phenomenal game Block by Block, which has been published. It sort of simulates an urban resistance to the police. Wonderful cooperative game. There's my friend Matteo Menapace and Matt Leacock's game Daybreak, which is an amazing cooperative game about climate change. There's a really phenomenal game called Hegemony, which recently came out. And beyond just board games, I think many radical thinkers and activists are turning to games as teaching tools. So I think about the Red Plenty Collective in Northern England, who are using mega games, which are sort of like big role-playing games with dozens of people playing, as means to think through, for instance, what are we going to do in the next 5 years of the climate disaster, or what would happen if a truly revolutionary government got elected. And many, many other people are using games in ways that can activate and release the radical imagination.
Yeah, some other games mentioned in your article in Jacobin are Class Struggle by Bertel Ohlmann, a socialist response to Monopoly, Jacobin's board game Class War, Lead Your Class to Victory, Chicago 68, Red Flag Over Paris, A Quiet Year. What do you make of the contention that some put forward that cooperative games are boring and sanctimonious?
Well, that might have been the case 20 years ago or 30 years ago. I certainly remember as a red diaper baby myself being, you know, given or gifted cooperative games that were pretty bad 40 years ago. But I think especially in the last 10 or 15 years, cooperative games have, within the board game renaissance, had their own renaissance. And much of that's thanks to the incredible work of Matt Leacock, whom I mentioned before, who's famous for creating the game Pandemic, which obviously became very popular during the pandemic, a cooperative game where you essentially play first responders and scientists and emergency managers working together to cure a global pandemic. So we're actually in an amazing moment for cooperative games, which I think is really turning on its head some of those assumptions. And really, I think more than that, you know, what's wonderful about games is they give you access to a way of practicing another way of being. They give you access to different forms of agency. They teach us to cooperate. Even competitive games teach us to cooperate insofar as you are cooperating with others to sit down and for a time enter what theorists call the magic circle and play by a certain set of rules. There's a cooperative element to all forms of play, even the most competitive. But cooperative games, I think, especially afford us the opportunity to learn how to cooperate differently and to put to use our skills of negotiation, diplomacy, cooperation, conviviality, imagination, all towards a common end. And I think they allow us to sort of exercise muscles that in our hyper-individualized competitive capitalist society, typically otherwise atrophy.
And as I said, my guest Max Haven has created his own board game. Actually, this is not the first, but Billionaires and Guillotines will be released by Pluto Press. And what, Max, got you into creating board games and creating this board game?
A few years ago, I was doing a project on conspiracy theories with my collaborators, Aris Komporosos Athanasiou and A.T. Kingsmith. And we became very fascinated with the gamification of conspiracy theories, and particularly the QAnon conspiracy fantasy, which to many game designers looked like it had been sort of concocted or orchestrated by a game designer, insofar as at the base of that conspiracy fantasy, you have some sort of mastermind codenamed Q, alleging on the internet to be an insider in Trump's administration, tasked with a kind of holy war against evil pedophiles and evildoers. And this Q character was sending out these very peculiar encrypted messages to his followers in the wider world that then the followers would come together on platforms like Reddit or WhatsApp groups or Facebook groups or YouTube channels and start to try and decipher this nonsense. And this is the same framework as many game designers were using in the previous 20 years to develop so-called alternate or augmented reality games. And I became very fascinated with this question and thought, well, if we really want to understand what's so appealing about conspiracy theories and why so many people believe them, then maybe we need to enter into this gaming space. And so I suggested to my collaborators that we make a game that eventually I made and was titled QAnon, which is sort of a kind of combination of Clue with QAnon with some other added features. And this sort of, I got bitten by the bug because I realized that making a game, regardless of if the game is good or not, or playable by other people or not, is an amazing way to investigate the world. It's an amazing way to investigate not only a complex system, which is modeled in the game, in this case, the kind of sociology of conspiracy theories. It's an amazing tool with which to model agency. So in a game like QAnon, I'm trying to understand why it is that conspiracy theories appeal to people not as sort of dumb consumers who are just fed a lie from some voice on high, but actually the way that these conspiracy theories succeed by seducing our sense of agency in a world where we feel typically we have very little agency. They make us feel like we can do things in the world, like we're part of something that matters, like we're not being played, but that we're actually players in this reality. And so with that as the background, I started working on a series of other games, especially to help my students understand key topics in social theory, because I also teach an introduction to social theory module at my university and cultural theory. And Billionaires and Guillotines emerged out of my efforts to create a game to help students understand Marxist theories of capitalist crisis. And ultimately, it began with the frustration that I think a lot of my students and a lot of people are very frustrated at rising wealth inequality. But within the kind of apparatus of the capitalist hegemony and the ideology that we all live under, we can only interpret that corporate power and billionaire power as the fault of individuals. And so we come to loathe people like Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk or Bill Gates or any of these other billionaires. But what often disappears from view is that these individuals are entirely replaceable within capitalism. All of these guys could go to Mars tomorrow and leave Earth to be, and as long as we had the system of capitalism, new billionaires would be put in their position. They are essentially swappable NPCs or non-player characters within the game of capitalism, even though they appear to us to be sort of these all-powerful agents. And so I wanted to create a game where the player could almost enter the shoes of these massively powerful and rich capitalist actors that we are told we should idolize.
So what happens in the game Billionaires and Guillotines? What do the players seek to accomplish?
What happens in the game, not to give too many spoilers, is that as you play the role of a billionaire trying to hoover up the assets of the world, you try and marry a celebrity spouse or build a private space program or get a private island or hire a mercenary army or buy art treasures. As you do this, you begin to realize that your actions are unleashing social and economic and political crises and ecological crises, and that in fact your attempts to compete with your other billionaires for status and for commodities is destroying the game itself. And my hope is that there's a moment of sort of Brechtian recognition here, that you sort of recognize your own subjectivity, your own sense of agency as it's tied up within the system that the game models. There's a moment of defamiliarization or a kind of positive estrangement or alienation where you realize that the way that the game has encouraged you to behave is so very contrary to not only your values, but to the purpose of the game itself. And through that, I hope that the game will sort of generate a critical moment for reflection so that when groups of people get together to play it, they can not only have a great time pretending to be billionaires and sort of satirizing the ruling class, but also have some reflections on the structural and systemic nature of why these people have been enriched and empowered, and what would need to be done to remove their power and their riches and redistribute them for the social good.
That's the voice of Max Haven, again, H-A-I-V-E-N. He is a cultural theorist, a writer, a teacher, a game maker, and Canada Research Chair in the Radical Imagination at Lakehead University in Thunder Bay, Canada. His books include Art After Money, Money After Art, and Cultures of Financialization. He's the editor of Vagabonds, a series of radical pamphlets from Pluto Press. And we are talking about his thoughts about games and politics and his board game, Billionaires and Guillotines, to be released by Pluto Press. I'm reading a description of the game that recapitulates some of what you just said. Players take on the role of 3 to 5 rival plutocrats vying to grab the wealth of the world before their actions trigger a revolution where they all lose a lot more than their assets. You've playtested the game with hundreds of folks. What have you learned in the process?
Well, I've first of all learned that actually antipathy to billionaires transcends the conventional political spectrum. I haven't played the game with a lot of extremely reactionary or fascist people, but I've played it with certainly some conservative people, and they too are very worried about growing wealth inequality and the incredible unfettered power of billionaires, especially since the election of the second Trump administration. I've also learned that people are eager to play, and that play is one of the main means by which we learn. You know, if you think about most of our engagements with a baby, you know, we are often playing even with babies at the youngest age. You know, peekaboo or something teaches babies object permanence. The games that we play with children are the games that children play amongst themselves, are the means by which they learn about the world, the social world, the physical world, and much else besides. So ultimately, games and play are a crucial means for education. And I think games like this, the wager or the gambit of the games like this, is that they can also be powerful tools for political education. And here I mean political education in the deepest critical sense. I don't just mean that a game can convey some ideological message that bashes people over the heads. And I've seen plenty of games that try and do this, you know, that try and just reverse Monopoly and put new graphics on the board or slightly new rules to try and, you know, propagandize to people about the evils of the system. No, I think that games offer us something even deeper, which is that when you invite a player to play a game, you invite them to bring their ingenuity and their imagination and their conviviality and their competitiveness even, but also their cooperative powers to bear, their full being in some ways. And you invite them to experiment in creating tactics and strategies that will work to their advantage, whether the game is competitive or cooperative. And through that process of learning a game and learning how to play a game better and to increase our capacities within a game, I think we have access to one of the most primordial and most important ways that humans can learn and learn together. And that's really been reinforced in my playing of the game with so many people in the playtests for Billionaires and Guillotines.
Max, how is the effort to get your game Billionaires and Guillotines published? How is that going?
Well, like many board games today, me and the publisher Pluto are running a crowdfunding campaign. And for those who are not familiar, a crowdfunding campaign is quite an interesting thing to develop on the internet in the last decade, where essentially you can put an idea out there, a prototype, and give people an opportunity to engage with it and say, look, if we get X number of people to pledge their support for this project, then we will be able to manufacture it and ship it to our backers. And those backers don't pay unless the project is successful. So for instance, if you say, well, we need to raise 28,000 Great British pounds, which is what we need to do to manufacture billionaires and guillotines, then only once we've got 28,000 pounds or more of pledges will the project be greenlit and will the people who made the pledges be charged for their pledges. You know, many people have criticized crowdfunding as the kind of next frontier of capitalism, where we're not just exploited by a boss, but we come to exploit ourselves in the vision that we could all be entrepreneurs, and that, you know, ultimately we are asking money from other working people rather than seizing resources back from the billionaires. But nonetheless, it does provide a lot of new opportunities for creative people who are producing products that do require quite a bit of capital, like a board game, for instance. So we're quite well on our way to reaching our goal. Our campaign will end on May 1st. We're still looking for backers. And if we're able to get them, we'll manufacture the game this summer, and it should be in people's hands this fall or early winter. The game will be manufactured sustainably using very good materials with no plastic, which has been a big priority of ours. But of course, it's very difficult to guarantee in today's manufacturing climate. And it's especially difficult for us to navigate the manufacturing and the logistics of getting the games to buyers because of the volatility in global markets, because of the new Trump tariffs, and the chaos in the logistics industry that's been going on since the pandemic, arguably.
Again, we have a link to this board game, Billionaires and Guillotines, on our website, againstthegrain.org. Max Haven, a cultural theorist of social movements and financialization, a writer and teacher based at Lakehead University in Ontario, Canada. We've been talking about a book he helped create called The World After Amazon, Speculative Stories from Amazon Workers, about an article in Jacobin Magazine about games and politics. We have links to all of these things and more on our website, againstthegrain.org. Max, thank you for your creative and intellectual efforts, and thank you for joining us today.
It's always a great pleasure to be on Against the Grain.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more.